should I be quiet?
I like to have this pre-show banter going on. I like, for some reason, I like having it in the beginning of the show.
Yeah, this will be the DVD set. This would be the outtakes.
Yeah, there'll be plenty of outtakes.
The pre-show banter special features.
Yes.
Greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso.
It's always this guess as to how long I'm going to let the music go before I start talking. But this time it was very short because our guest is already on the phone and I'm going to have to transfer the... But the music is so good. I always like it. That was... That music is actually... a copyright free. There is the siren. Copyright free music that Ed Wood used from a music library. Wow, is the president here? That's like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 police cars. Eight.
Eight police cars just went by.
Eight police cars and a helicopter. Oh, nine and a helicopter. So something very important is going on in this neighborhood right now. Ken, can you hear me?
Another typical Sunday night on that street corner, I guess.
Yeah. Have you ever been in the studio here?
I have, yes.
And it is not a show unless there are scads of sirens going by. And people
makes
think
you,
it's because it's...
you feel that the city is alive, you know?
Yeah, I'm alive in the big city here. It's Radio Mysterioso, and there's another one! Wow, there's like an apocalypse here.
That was right on cue.
Yeah.
How do you get them to do that?
Okay, that's 10, 11. Wow, I think I'd rather just stop the show and go and chase them and see what's going on. Oh, what was that? There's 12?
And man, he's a 12 alarm emergency.
Yeah, it's... all available units are going over there to show up whatever it is. I bet if I turn on the radio, there's going to be a standoff somewhere or something. Yeah, it actually is LAPD, so it's Dragnet, right? Yeah, it's Dragnet.
The Naked City.
Dragnet. Or that, no, well, Naked City took place supposedly in New York, or at least a large East Coast city, right?
That's right, yeah. But L.A. is as naked as any city, really.
Yeah, there goes two more without their sirens on. That was nice. Wow. Ken Thomas is, as Rob Sterling
Hello.
Described, America's best love conspiracy researcher. And I'm going to keep calling him that, whether he likes
Rob
it or not.
Rob has a way with words.
Yeah. Originally,
but you know what? I use your quote more, actually.
What's what?
On radio shows that I do, because I love it, from the first edition of the Boy Island book. Information rich to the point of saturation. I want that on my grave.
Was it to the point... God, I can't remember that's the exact quote. I do have the original Moya Island book in front of me.
It's a rare one, you know. You can sell that thing for $200.
What? The original Illuminate Press 1999 printing of Maury Island UFO, the Crisman Conspiracy. Really?
It's selling for $230. Same thing that happened with the octopus.
How about?
And I would advise you to sell it quickly, because what happened with the octopus, it was selling for like $300 until the second edition came out, and then the prices on it plummeted. So now that we've got basically, I'm actually kind of reluctant to even say the new book is a new edition of the Maury Island book, because it's really not. It's I totally rewrote the narrative of the thing. It's got all these extra sidebars. It's like a completely different book.
Yeah, I was reading it, and as I got further into it, I realized how much different it is. We're talking with Ken Thomas, who originally published Steam Shovel Press, and still does, I believe.
I do.
A magazine of parapolitics and things related to them, which everything that Ken and I talk about is related. We met, I think, in 98 or 97 or something like that.
Was that it? You weren't at the famous Phenomicon in 92?
No. I just started publishing Excluded Middle in 92, me and Robert Larson and Peter Stensel. Yeah.
You should have been there in Atlanta in 92. That's when Jim Keith and Adam Parfrey and me and Len Bracken and the whole Conspiracy Underground zinesters all kind of met for the first time.
Yeah, I think, well, that was kind of the front of the zine thing.
What?
It was a front of the zine wave coming in. That was like the swell.
Yes. I remember. I was just actually talking to Adam about this, reminiscing about this, because I remember I was doing some research on Wilhelm Reich, you know, which I often do, and being totally bugged by this guy who, whenever he discovered somebody was into Reich, he would just hit them with wave upon wave of phone calls and harassment at all hours and stuff like this, just to talk to him, to talk to, you know, a new Reichian fan. And it was really annoying the crap out of me. And we were at this one dinner, I was on mushrooms, and Keith was there, Bracken was there, and then Parfrey started doing an imitation of this guy's voice, you know. And at that point, I thought I was suffering this thing alone, you know. I mean, realizing that Adam Parfrey, who knew who this creep was and could actually imitate his voice, the most hilarious thing I'd ever experienced.
I keep hearing about that, or I did for quite a long time, the Phenomicon, what went on there. I think a lot of the subgenius people were there, or at least some of the main people were there. And
that's right. Ron Bonds was there too, of course, and Bruce Sterling. There was a whole cyberpunk element there. It was a really strange collection of people that never really came together again. You know, it's not like a Star Trek convention that happens every year or something.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it was kind of a one-time thing. Ken has also written many, 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 many books, far more than I could probably name, not the least of which is the most recent one, JFK and UFO, Military Industrial Conspiracy and Cover-Up from Maury Island to Dallas. But it also says on the front cover, co-author of Octopus and Secret and Suppressed 2. But you had so many others. I mean, the Gemstone File was one of them. What else?
Right. Not 53 of them, though. Some guy just wrote an article about me. He said I have 53 titles in print. I wish. I have about 15 books in print, actually.
23 there are, I think.
23, yeah. And that includes NASA Nazis and JFK, Mind Controlled Oswald and JFK, Popular Alienation, Popular Paranoia, Parapolitics, the Octopus, of course.
Yeah. One and
the
two.
Cyberculture volumes, all kinds of stuff that I can't even remember really half the time.
Yeah, and he's still in demand, as far as I know, as a lecturer at different. Are you going to the Conspiracon or whatever they call it up in the Bay Area this year?
I think it's already passed.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. You're right. You're right. Yeah. That's right. It was a month or two ago.
Yeah. Now, my current plans are actually still kind of vague, but I think I'm going to make it up to Seattle, where, of course, a lot of the, you know, Seattle, Tacoma region is where a lot of this, the story of the book happens.
Yeah.
And
appearances
there. And a lot of times when I get to Seattle, I hook up with my old buddy Dick Dobb, who was connected to the old Magical Blend magazine.
Oh, yeah.
And we drive down to L.A. You know, we'll drive that whole West Coast Highway 1 thing. So maybe I'll be coming there.
Yes, and you'll be a live guest on the show if you're here on Sunday. If not, I guess we'll just have to record something. I don't think I've ever pre-recorded a show, not once. But there's a first time for everything.
What?
I've never pre-recorded a show, not once. They've always been live.
Is this considered pre-recorded, or are we out live?
Well, I mean, I do a live show. Yes, we're out live, but then I put it up online so people can download it as a podcast because that's the way things have been going for quite a while. But, yeah, I still do a live show.
More people will listen to the podcast, though, right?
Oh, yeah, many, many, many more. I mean, I get 20, 30, 40 people listening to the show. It's growing, though. It seems to be a little more every week. And then I'll get a few hundred, or in some cases, a few thousand downloading the podcast. So
that's great. That's great. Now, of those 100 or so, maybe 10 or so listening to this interview will buy the book, and I will get a royalty somewhere 2 or 3 years down the road of $1 or $2. You know, as a professional writer, I like to keep track of this.
When I first read, we'll talk about this book, but the information when you first uncovered it, when I read it, I didn't know about this background in Maury Island and what happened and how Kenneth Arnold was involved to a very heavy degree. Ray Palmer was involved to a very heavy degree. And then, of course, somebody you uncovered that was very heavily involved, Fred Chrisman, who was important in the JFK milieu of players, especially according to Jim Garrison. And we can describe. Can you give like a short thing of that for people who are just
completely out of the loop on it? The short thing for people who are not familiar with it at all, they should remember one simple fact, is that Jim Garrison thought that Fred Chrisman was the Grassy Knoll shooter. That should bring it together for a lot of people. Now, a lot of people don't know this because, you know, Oliver Stone did a whole movie about the Jim Garrison case, and Fred Chrisman is not mentioned in there at all. But you would think, you know, this is a pivotal character. You know, the guy who shot from the Grassy Knoll. And what it was Stone makes it clear in the movie that Clay Shaw, the guy that Garrison prosecuted, was just a toehold on the larger conspiracy. They say that in there, you know. Just the guy that they had enough to take to court on. The other guy, actually, that he wanted to indict, and he never got to the point where he ever indicted Chrisman, but there was another guy named Edgar Eugene Bradley, who Ronald Reagan, your glorious governor there, who wouldn't have been governor had Timothy Leary not been thrown in jail, he wouldn't extradite the Bradley guy. So that didn't happen. Clay Shaw was prosecuted. Clay Shaw was acquitted. But shortly, and a poll of the jurors said that Garrison just simply didn't make the case that Shaw was connected to the CIA. And it was pretty solidly proven later, years later, when Victor Marchetti released his memo that Clay Shaw was a CIA guy. So, I mean, everything Garrison did was really kind of right on the money. But the idea that, Chrisman is the Grassy Knoll shooter is something that's just kind of, you know, a lot of people don't even know. And the significance of that, of course, is that Chrisman was a witness to the Maury Island case in 1947, which was the first of the cases after the Second World War. It actually happened before Kenneth Arnold. So there's the broad stroke picture for people who don't know what we're talking about. A guy involved with the first UFO case after the war was later subpoenaed by Jim Garrison as part of his investigation of the Kennedy assassination, a suspect of being the Grassy Knoll shooter.
What is the significance, though? I mean, I know what the significance is because there's connections through the military-industrial complex and through private contractors and aerospace stuff in the Northwest at the time. But when people say, well, how the hell is somebody in a UFO sighting connected to the JFK assassination? Who cares? You know, what? I'm sure people have said that, right?
Well, yeah, sure. People say that all the time. I mean, people say, hey, I saw a UFO, and people say, well, who cares about that? People say, right. You know, I think Oswald was part of a conspiracy, and people say, who cares? This whole business of dismissing important things happens.
Oh, but the thing is, if you're willing...
And this is... What's that?
If you're willing to listen and you think it might be important, what would you say? To somebody that said, please explain that to me, what the connection is. And I just I kind of made an a very short assessment of the military-industrial complex and intelligence connections. But what's a better explanation?
Yeah, well, it always depends on who you're talking to, and what they want to know, and what they're able to accept. You know, I mean, and this is really the thing about the new book. And like you said, the new book's called JFK and UFO, is that it really kind of focuses more completely on an intertwining connection between the parapolitical world of assassinations and conspiracies and the ufological subculture. And it really kind of it attempts to demonstrate how those two things work together, and they work together to today. So it kind of gives you much more complete picture of the world that you live in than you would otherwise have. That's what I would say, you know, just as a kind of a generic response to that. But, you know, recently I got a kind of an offhanded swipe in a review of Joseph Farrell's recent book on Lyndon Johnson.
Oh, yeah.
By the, yeah, somebody totally trashed that book in the CTKA newsletter, the Citizens for the Truth, about the Kennedy assassination, which is a newsletter that's run, was for a while run by Lisa Pease and Jim DiEugenio. And I'm just mentioned in passing because he talks about my work with the Torbett document and doesn't actually bring this up. But the guy who wrote the review actually interviewed me. I cleaning out my old emails, I noticed this guy was very friendly towards me. He gave me all these compliments about the octopus work and all this other stuff. And I had no idea that he was antagonistic or was going to be critical or anything. I answered a whole bunch of questions for him, and then he comes out and he just totally trashes me in this review. So, you know, even if you are kind and you try to, you know, explain to people why this book is important, they're going to walk away and do whatever they want with it. So,
yeah, but if somebody who potentially wanted to read the book and thought that there was an interesting story there, what would you tell them the significance was? Because when you read it, of course, you see what is the premise you set out.
Ooh, that's an interesting question.
Why is the fact that Fred Crisman, who was you have already established was important to Jim Garrison in the JFK assassination investigation, why is the fact that he was involved with very heavily with one of the first major UFO sightings of the modern era, even before Roswell, actually, which you point out, why is that connection important?
Well, it just kind of helped to establish the fact that these the things that culminated in the Kennedy assassination in 63 had been happening since the late 40s. And, of course, Eisenhower warned about them in his famous retirement speech, The Military-Industrial Complex. That's why the subtitle of the book is Conspiracy and Cover-Up, Military-Industrial Conspiracy and Cover-Up from Maury Island to Dallas. It's about how the development of the military security state and how it culminated in the assassination of JFK and sent, you know, our whole culture into a weird tailspin and turned it into a kind of a science fiction nightmare.
Yeah,
does that answer the question?
It's sort
yeah,
of.
The other thing would be is that it's the only book. It's only one of two books that have JFK and UFO in the title. The other book is Richard Belzer's book.
Oh, that's right.
JFK, UFOs, and Elvis Presley, or something.
Yeah.
But
right.
Go ahead. I should mention too that I do a review of the whole Nazi occult technology connection to flying saucers. Actually, in the book that Beckley has out now. What's it called? To Hell and Back
Round
in
trip,
a Flying Saucer?
Round Trip to Hell in a Flying Saucer, a reprint of one of the best UFO titles I've ever heard.
It is. It is a reprint, but it's also it's an added-on edition. There's a whole chapter in there by me about the history of flying saucers and the Nazis, the connection between flying saucers and the Nazis. So that's out. And I should also mention, too, that Childress just reprinted Jim Keith's classic book on the case book on the Men in Black.
Yeah.
And I wrote the introduction to that new edition. So it's got new stuff in it in addition to it being a classic work. So I've been doing all that, and also I've revived the Steam Shovel Press website. So I've been pretty busy doing a lot of different kinds of things like that.
So the importance of Chrisman is that he was involved in building up this what culminated in the Kennedy assassination. He was a major player in the background, and the very weird thing is that he's involved with this UFO sighting, which you told me you thought was a real actual sighting of something that wasn't our technology.
Well, no, actually, Chrisman's participation in the Moyan event is a little bit more complicated than that, and a little bit more suspect. I mean, you could you really got to cast doubt on everything that Chrisman has ever said about himself.
Yeah,
the original
Moy
Island incident, of course, was Harold Dahl.
Yeah.
Harold Dahl and the people on the North Queen, the ship. They saw these five saucers, six of them, actually one of them was wobbling and spilling out this slag that fell down on their harbor patrol boat. And even then the details get foggy because they were not harbor patrolmen. They were freelance people who were recovering logs. When logs break free from being sent downstream, they're all branded, and if you can recover logs that have been lost and identify the brand and give them back to the lumber company, you get a reward. That's how these people made their money.
Yeah.
They're out there on their ship doing this when they get bombarded with this crap from the sky. They call it flag, white stuff and black stuff. And it hits the ship, causes damage to the ship, hits Harold Dahl's son, Charles, damages his arm, kills their dog, this crap does, and they have a bad day all around about it. And then one of the saucers taps the one that's wobbling, straightens it up, and they all fly away. Chrisman didn't come down until after Dahl went and told him that story.
Yeah.
He came down the next day, and then he said he saw another saucer the next day. And his description of the saucer does not match Dahl's. He says he saw a convex, saw concave type thing. So it could be that Chrisman was just grafting himself onto the experience.
Right.
Because Dahl, for some reason, thought that Chrisman was his boss, even though I established with the research in there that the registration of the ship was to Dahl. Dahl owned the ship, you know. But for some reason, he felt necessary to report to Chrisman what had happened to it. That's really just the beginning of all the murky things about Fred Chrisman that make it a fascinating an important story that has, like I said, it has to do with both how the spy world works, you know, because all this, there may not have been any flying saucers. I mean, I'll be the first person to rush to tell you the other explanation, that whatever Chrisman was doing, he was trying to protect, for instance, nuclear dumping from the Hanford nuclear plant, or as Michael Reconosciuto suggested, that these saucers were actually radar fogging devices. So there are all kinds of explanations about that.
Was there was the Hanford plant there in 1947?
It was, but the dumping doesn't really make any sense. Explain it all. You have to take a look at a map to see why it doesn't.
Well, that's pretty cool. There. Whoa, Ken got cut off as soon as he started talking about the Hanford nuclear power plant. Let's call him and see if he's still there.
There?
I suggest we don't talk about the Hanford nuclear power plant anymore, because as soon as you started talking about it, there was a horrible buzzing noise, and then you got cut off.
Okay, well, let me just say one thing about it, because it's interesting, before they cut us off again, because there's an interesting current bit of research that's not actually in the book, something that I just discovered, okay?
Yeah.
So bear with me.
Please.
On this story. One of the things about Chrisman is that he was indicted in 1968, and one of the current popular science fiction UFO-related show at the time was called The Invaders with Roy Thinnes.
Yeah.
A lot of people know what that is. Chrisman felt that show was about him, you know? And people laugh that off, you know, it's just Chrisman being paranoid or whatever. And
or lying.
In the book, I make the point that The Invaders was a Quinn Martin production. And Quinn Martin did these kind of procedural cop shows one of which was called the FBI.
Yeah.
And it was discovered that there was a consultant to the FBI program, a guy named Mark Felt, who is now universally recognized as Deep Throat from the Watergate days. So the idea that the covert world was connected and actually doing consulting work for those kinds of TV shows is pretty much kind of established by that. Maybe that's a weak link, but what I found out since in looking up stuff on Mark Felt is that in the 1940s, Mark Felt was responsible for reviewing employment applications at the Hanford nuclear plant.
What was he doing there?
What's that?
Was he with the FBI then? Hey, Hassan.
Yes. And apparently the FBI had some role in reviewing these things, and I have a copy of Crisman's application form. So Felt knew of Crisman, or at least saw that form. And that fits into a lot of really, you know, once you learn why you wouldn't be fascinated with it, I don't know. I know a lot of people dismiss this as a hoax, and we can talk about that. But
you mean Maury Island?
The Maury Island thing as a hoax. But the idea that Fred Crisman, that Mark Felt knew Fred Crisman, we know that Jim Garrison probably knew Fred Crisman, at least of Fred Crisman in the 1940s, because he knew Guy Bannister. And Guy Bannister was in the Pacific Northwest.
FBI.
He was an FBI agent in the Pacific Northwest who had handled a flying saucer, and Garrison talks about he'd had lunch with him. There's no way that he couldn't know it. Ray Palmer knew who Fred Crisman was before Maury Island because he'd published Deros letters by Crisman before Maury Island, but he never told that to Kenneth Arnold. So Crisman's presence, wherever he goes, is kind of telegraphed, and there's all this kind of weird, spooky stuff. This is the only book ever written on it, but I really just feel like I've opened the doors. There's still a ton of things that really need to be studied and understood about this thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the connection with Guy Bannister and Crisman being in sort of the same area at the same time and then popping up in New Orleans later. Well, Crisman didn't.
That's right. Yeah, we should say that. Yeah, for those people who don't know, Guy Bannister, played by Ed Asner in the Oliver Stone movie, ran the Fair Play for Cuba Committee out of an office in New Orleans, and his most famous employee was Lee Harvey Oswald. And that's always a cue to do a quick biographical review of Oswald, for people who don't know, that he served in Natsuki, Japan, where the U-2s flew out of. He was in the Soviet Union right before they got the information they needed to shoot down Gary Powers' U-2. His job at Jagachal Stovall, the photographic firm, the job he had before the book depository job, that firm processed U-2 films. He was some kind of operative connected to the U-2 program. And, of course, the U-2 was developed at Area 51.
Yeah.
So these are the kinds of the connections. I mean, a lot of times you'll get into the UFO world and you'll see crazy people talking about Kennedy was shot because he was going to expose what had happened at Roswell. And that's not this book. I don't say that. But this book is a very researched article about what the real connection is to what we understand about UFOs, flying saucers, why it's in, how our culture has reacted to it, what we know about it, and how it's connected to the conspiracies and the assassinations that have characterized our political life for the last half century.
Right. It's funny that I started talking about it at the beginning of the show. I said that the background of the investigation, the aftermath of the Maury Island sighting, was revelatory to me because I didn't know that that Kenneth Arnold was involved in it. I didn't know that, you know, Crisman for that matter. I didn't know about the kidnapping or disappearance of Harold Dahl's son, the main witness, a Men in Black thing going on in 1947 before anybody really talked about it or it was even a thing. Just the general strangeness surrounding the first, you know, basically the first close encounter of the modern era that anybody really knew about and predating Kenneth Arnold. Oh, no. Was Arnold's sighting was...
It was like 3 days after Maury Island, yeah.
Yeah. Arnold's, it even predated Maury Island. I mean, Kenneth Arnold's sighting as well.
Right.
So all this
stuff... But the idea of the hoax, this is what has thrown a lot of people off, and a lot of really good UFO researchers dismiss the Maury Island case because the major witness, Harold Dahl, eventually started claiming that it was all a hoax. And so this was actually, it was a well-known case after Kenneth Arnold became famous. The Coming of the Saucers, the book that Palmer and Arnold did together.
Yeah.
All the Maury Island details are in there, you know. It was known, but people have soft-pedaled it, condemned it, you know, just said it's just a bunch of hoaxsters and con men because Harold Dahl said it was a hoax. The reason Harold Dahl said it was a hoax was because when he first, when it first happened, he was telling everybody. And then what always happens when somebody sees a UFO and they start telling everybody?
Yeah.
A man in black show up. A man in black comes up and he says, listen, buddy, if you keep talking about this, bad things are going to happen to you. And his business started going downhill. His wife got sick. His kid was disappeared and wound up in Wyoming somewhere with amnesia bussing tables. And all this terrible crap started happening to Harold Dahl, and he got the picture. And at that point he said, okay, it's a hoax. Never mind me, folks. Never mind. It's a hoax. We were making it up. It's just a big joke.
Yeah, well, that and, on top of people just making fun of him, I think, in a general way.
Well, yeah, in a general way, but also, you know, just because, you know, somebody had warned him that bad things were going to happen to him if he kept talking. He kept talking, and bad things happened to him. And,
so he finally listened.
And it all makes perfect sense. Now, the idea, though, that it was a hoax or that it's trivial or that it's an inconsequential footnote to the history of modern ufology is belied by the fact that after Kenneth Arnold got to a dead end in his investigation, he called in a couple of Air Force guys, Davidson and Brown, who talked to Dahl and Crisman, who had Dahl and Crisman actually give them some of this flag that they had, loaded it up on their airplane, flew off. Actually, they're flying off for the ceremony that actually made the Air Force for the first time a distinct division apart from the Army.
At McCord?
What's that?
Was it at McCord Field they were flying to?
Yes, 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 yes. And the plane crashed, and these men were killed. You know, high-ranking intelligence officers, investigators, were killed in a very crash of a very expensive piece of Air Force equipment. And there was never an investigation, and there was never a prosecution, and there was never any official inquiry into, you know, even though they were on that plane, they just loaded up the Maury Island stuff. They just, you know, they were had it. Just talked to Dahl and Crisman. Nothing ever came of it. Serious, serious stuff. You know, not trivial, not a footnote, and a very important thing that happened there. I mean, there's all kinds of fanciful theories about it, but once you actually look at the facts, you can't just walk away and say that there's nothing going on here.
Well, there's definitely something important going on which concerns somebody up there enough that attention was paid, more than a normal amount of attention. I've never really tried to figure out whether the plane was sabotaged or not, especially seeing as how the Air Force was sending their own people out there, and those people were bringing stuff back to, I think they were going to try and deliver it to Wright-Patterson, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the theories about it is, actually what happened was after the crash, of course, the flag disappeared. You know, they didn't recover it from the debris.
Right.
And a counterintelligence team was sent out, and their recommendation was that if anything like this ever happened again in the future, that stuff should go to the Foreign Technologies desk in the Army, which is where Corso said the Roswell stuff was meted out.
Right.
But one of the theories is that that Crisman sabotaged the plane, and that he recovered the flag, or maybe when he gave them, he supposedly gave them a Kellogg's cornflakes box full of the flag.
You know,
maybe that was a bomb or something else. But whatever it was, one of the theories is that Crisman held on to this stuff, this proof that there is an alien invasion, that the government is covering up something about flying saucers or whatever. And since he was supposedly an agent of some sort going back to the OSS, the pre-CIA days, he held on to this and he used it as kind of a blackmail in order to get the choice assignment. He basically kind of disappears right after Maury Island, and there's all kinds of stories about what he did in the interim until he reemerges in the 60s. But that's the idea, that maybe he used this flag to parlay himself that primo job of shooting Kennedy from the grassy knoll.
Well, I guess if he didn't like him, or if it's somebody's behest.
If you were a guy like that, that would be, that would be a real boon for you, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, in that world, your reputation would be made if you shot Kennedy and got away with it.
Yeah. If there is anybody that wants to examine why this theory interests Ken and interests me, there's actually a picture of the so-called hobos that were arrested near the grassy knoll, and one of them, as far as you know, I can tell, is almost a dead ringer for Chrisman.
That's right. That's right. And actually, what's interesting is that Garrison brought that photograph on the Johnny Carson show. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, yeah. And actually, if you get the director's cut of JFK on DVD, there are scenes in it that were not in the theatrical release. John LaRoquette plays Johnny Carson. And and I've got the audio of the show. You know, Carson's shows were all erased to reuse the tapes, right?
Yeah.
I do have an audio of the actual show. And Garrison is holding up the Tramp tape, the Tramp's photo, and he's going to start naming them. And Johnny Carson cuts him off, and they go to a commercial. But Garrison is not the only person to identify Chrisman as possibly one of those hobos. The other main source that suggested that is the Torbit document, which is this samizdat bit of literature that's been passed around in the JFK research community since the early 70s. That is basically, you know, setting out one scenario of behind-the-scenes stuff that led to the assassination. And it had the Tramp photographs, and it said that one of the Tramps was Fred Chrisman.
And when did that document surface?
The Torbit document probably, it's unclear, late 60s, early 70s.
Well, way before anybody was interested in Fred Chrisman for anything except maybe the Maury Island thing, which most people didn't associate him with anyway.
Well, yeah, it's very interesting because, you know, Maury Island's not mentioned in the Torbit document at all, but a big chunk of the Torbit document mentions all the paperclip Nazi scientists and, in fact, argues that Clay Shaw was involved in the surrender of Wernher von Braun. And it was part of the guy, the team that everybody knows what paperclip is, right? Your audience.
Yes, and if they don't, they shouldn't be listening.
That's right. So the document, you know, I produced another value-added edition, first published copy ever of the Torbit document called NASA Nazis and JFK.
Yeah.
And it does talk about all this Nazi link, and it talks about the wink document, the wink photograph, which Albert Thomas winking at Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One. Albert Thomas was responsible for the funding of NASA, and the whole aerospace connection there, without at all mentioning Fred Chrisman. But at the same time that the Torbit document came out, Garrison got a letter, an anonymous letter, and I reproduced that in the book, that makes the same charge. It says, you know, Chrisman was the grassy knoll shooter, and that he was connected to Clay Shaw.
Right.
So I also include in there, I did find one document in the National Archives that kind of exonerates Clay Shaw, proves that Clay Shaw was in America when von Braun surrendered, but that could only mean that he was managing the U.S. side of things. You know, it doesn't really mean that he wasn't involved.
Well, there's plenty of evidence that he was working for the OSS at least for a bit of for a few
that's
years.
That's right. We know a lot more about Clay Shaw now than we ever did during the trial, and it was pretty much a blackguard of some sort.
So the new edition, as you said, I was reading it, and it seemed like the other one, except with extensive footnotes and some sidebars, like this one on Gerald Hurd, who is you told me about when you were trying to get this tape of this guy released, because he had written about Maury Island and I think about Chrisman, wasn't it? And then when the book was published, the chapter about Chrisman was taken out.
Yeah,
who was this guy?
Gerald Hurd is a famous British philosopher. He's on the scale of Aldous Huxley or Alan Watts. He was a very well-known British philosopher, kind of known for writing these philosophy books, not about flying saucers, but he wrote one of the first books about flying saucers. It was called The Riddle of the Flying Saucers, and it came out in Britain in 1950, I think. And it had a whole chapter on Maury Island. And in fact, we have an outstanding engagement, Greg, you and I, to go find the manuscript collection that has correspondence about this.
Which is located where?
Chapter, it's at, remember, we
was it UCLA or something?
Yeah, in UCLA. So I'm going to come out there, and we're going to go and see if we can find it.
I'll go.
Because I came up with a dead end. Just to make it clear, the U.S. edition of the book, which is called Is Another World Watching, does not have the Moore Island chapter. Disappeared. So why? Why? Did Heard believe the story that it was a hoax? Was there some other kind of pressure put on it? On him to take it out. I mean, it's still a question. And I thought I could get closer to it because I discovered, just fortuitously, that Heard actually spoke here in the city where I live in 1950 at a local university, and that they had recorded it. And I work in an archive, people know, and the archivist actually, where this was being held, someone I trained, I know her, you know?
Yeah,
and I called her up and I said, "Listen, I got to hear this tape." And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, this tape's too old. It'll flake off if you put the reel on the machine." And I said, "Okay, well, let me take it to my shop. We can digitize it, you know."
Yeah.
And sorry, tapes don't circulate outside the archive. So I'm like, "Well, what's the use?
Why don't you just throw it away then?
Could listen to right?" And that went on for weeks, and then just by chance. A vendor approached this other university about possibly digitizing their entire collection, which, of course, they don't have money for. No archives has any money for anything, actually.
Yeah.
These vendors were willing to offer them a free sample of their work. And so because I knew the archivist woman there, and she knew my interest, and she was as kind of as frustrated as I was that she couldn't let me listen to the tape, she gave it to him. She gave it to the vendors, and the vendors digitized it, because she could get approval from her higher-ups for a vendor to do it, whereas she couldn't give it to me to do it. So I got to listen to it. I got to listen to this fabulous, fabulous talk about flying saucers from 1950 by this brilliant, articulate man talking to what must have been a very staid 1950 Midwestern audience. And there are so many brilliant things about the speech. I feel very lucky that I've been able to listen to it. I don't know if anybody else is going to be able to do it. And and I wrote a sidebar article about it, and it's in there. We don't know why that chapter on Moore Island isn't in his book. But we do have what I think is a fabulous kind of side note to a story that, an apocryphal story that Kessler wrote about in The Sleepwalkers, that everybody knows, the story of Galileo and the clerics he invited over to look through the telescope to see the moons of Jupiter, but they couldn't see it because their paradigm didn't allow them. They believed in the Earth-centered universe and the idea that there are satellites around another planet. It's there for anybody to see with your eyes, but it didn't fit into their mind, so they didn't see it. Everybody knows that story, and Kessler made the comparison to flying saucers and the modern scientific mainstream point of view, that they can't see it, so they're not going to see it. Okay, and that's a good point. But the other point that Heard made was that also Galileo saw the rings of Saturn. With his equipment, they were like teacup handles. You know, they weren't actually rings, but then they disappeared. And he made a note. He said, Saturn devours its children. And that was the last he ever dealt with Saturn. And that note was a reference to ancient mythology about the god Saturn. And Heard's speculation was that, you know, here's Galileo who had discovered the moons of Jupiter. He could have added to those discoveries. He could have discovered the rings of Saturn. But for some reason, he writes down this note that refers to the ancients, who maybe he felt that they knew more than he did. And so, therefore, he wasn't going to, you know, deal with it. Whereas the clerics couldn't see it, he wouldn't go back to see it. You know, so that the religion and science, that's the double whammies, and why they can never understand what the reality of the flying saucer phenomenon is all about. So anyway, that's all one of the sidebars.
Well, I like that sidebar. It's interesting. I have people asking questions by instant message. Adam Gorightly writes and asks, "You want to hear his question?"
Sure. Do I? I don't know. Do I? Adam.
He said, please ask Ken. So, Yeah, he said, ask Ken, so did a UFO kill JFK or what?
Yeah, or what.
I said, I already asked him that sort of in the beginning. Goes, oh, I came in late. He goes, but I'm serious. I wanted to ask, how did a UFO kill JFK?
Well, okay, let me use that as a springboard to a serious response. Thank you.
Sure.
That, again, this is not about JFK getting shot because he was going to expose the Roswell crash. What it's about, what Garrison thought was going on, was that Crisman was working for Boeing. And if you read Seymour Hersh's book, The Dark Side of Camelot, you'll get details about this. But there was a contract that was supposed to go to Boeing. It instead went to General Dynamics.
Yeah, the TFX.
And in response to this, or in retaliation to this, or as part of a whole big mosaic of get Kennedy stuff, is that what is that?
Yeah, there they go again. Now there's fire engines going the other direction. Wow, this is the most incredible performance of emergency vehicles I've had here in a while. Amazing.
Great. They're all parked around the studio now.
Yeah, they're all they're swarming. I mean, there's something seriously going wrong. Well, we heard fireworks from behind us, east or west of us, and now I see a bunch of fire trucks going west. So maybe something went wrong with the fireworks. Go
crazy.
Ahead. I'm sorry. It was the normal Radio Mysterio. So you know, yeah, you only know you have the genuine article if you hear the sirens. You were asking, you were answering the, so did UFOs kill JFK? And you were on, God, what
oh,
part?
Yeah, I was saying that, Crisman, according to Garrison,
yes.
Was in that part of the military industrial complex that we know as a private aerospace firm called Boeing. I understand, actually, it's very interesting, and I have to look it up a little bit more closely, that Obama is involved in some kind of controversy around Boeing right now, too.
Ah, I haven't heard that one yet.
Yeah, there's something going on. And I'm going to look that up and say more about it at steamshovelpress.com. That'll give me let me gather my wits here and plug my website, steamshovelpress.com.
You can plug that as much as you want. That's why people are on this show, besides the fact that I like to talk to them and you're a friend of mine.
Well, yeah, and the thing is I talk fast and I say a million different things and nobody can ever follow me.
Oh, that's just how I am.
Yeah. So take any thread you want and you can follow it up at steamshovelpress.com because you can find my email address there. There's also a Steam Shovel Press Facebook account and a Facebook page, which are different things, apparently. I don't know much about it. And I'm slowly but surely doing more things on it and trying to, you know, get things out that way. But the point I wanted to make, though, was that this contract was for the Technical Fighter Experimental, the TFX, which is an experimental plane at the time.
Yep.
That JFK just gave to the wrong person, and in revenge, and again as part of a whole bigger picture that had to do with Kennedy was reducing the number of advisors that we had in Vietnam, was kind of reversing the war effort, which was going against the military-industrial complex, then too. All those things came together, and this TFX fighter was eventually became the F-111. Which was sold to Australia, and the whole structure around there, what they call a funding corridor, was created by this thing that eventually led to the creation of Pine Gap in Alice Springs, Australia, which is
GOP.
The Australian version of Area 51.
Yeah. Hey, Adam just won't shut up. He said,
he's
wow,
my biggest fan, you know.
Yeah, he's a huge fan. He says, hey, could you ask Ken, does he believe in aliens? He's just
illegal kind.
Of course you. Well, I don't know. Do you believe in the illegal kind? I don't know. I think he's talking about the Maury Island kind, or whatever you want to call it, the popular version of the non-human entity.
Yes.
That's exactly what I wrote when he said, "Do you ask Ken if does he believe in ETs?" And I wrote, "Yes."
You know me well. You know me well. Well, you know, a lot of these, I find great humor. And, you know, a lot of people will get sick of the ET hypothesis and all this other stuff and then present something else. Like, you know, like Nick's last thing about, you know, the military clique that believes that it's their demons.
It's demonic, yeah.
Yeah, they're demonic. Oh, okay, well, thank God you got a more sensible explanation than the ET hypothesis there. Thank you guys.
Well, this show, we talk about that a lot, and there's a lot of different theories, and the aliens from other planets thing, we have discarded, at least we, meaning the royal we, I discarded that a long time ago, is untenable and mostly uninteresting. So, yeah,
right. It's probably more likely to be demons from hell than extraterrestrials from other planets.
I think it's more likely here that we might call demons, and we just like calling them aliens or whatever, and it's convenient to us to say they come from other planets. I don't know whether demons are right or anytime somebody doesn't understand something, they call it a demon. You know, anything paranormal.
Well, yeah, I'm like, God, our military
fundamentalist views.
Our military has, for a long time, been run by crazy Christian people who believe that, you know, flying saucers are demons from hell. It's just a crazy belief. There's nothing new or alternative about that.
I mean, a lot of people didn't know that or didn't think about it much. Why? Do you agree with Nick? It's not Nick's hypothesis. It's just what he's reporting on. But you believe there's people in the military that think that and along the lines of what Nick was talking about. Have you read any of his book?
Who, Nick?
Yeah, the final events.
No, you never sent that to me. I've listened to his interviews at that point, but that's one that I missed. I'll tell you the book I've been reading, though, is that Jacobson's book, right?
Which one?
Area 51, The Uncensored History.
Oh, what do you think of that? I don't want to read it because it's... Well, I should, you know, because there's probably a lot of clues and interesting things in there. What do you think?
There's a lot of... you know who really hates the book?
UFO Skyler. People. Oh.
This guy was like visceral. Oh, I hate that bitch. Ew. I think he even like went to one of the in stores or something to confront
her. Yeah, well, that's okay because Paul Kimball was on a few weeks ago here with Walter, and we had some beers, and he used some choice language about the author as well.
I can't say. I was in Hartford, Connecticut, in the airport when I first saw the book, and I thought, wow, a nice big chunky book on Area 51, and I didn't realize how much he had saturated the media at that point. That was the first I saw it, was in the airport. I practically, you know, read half the book in the airport. Just on the photos alone, I mean, there's a photograph of JFK at Area 25, for instance. The basic thesis that has hit the news that Roswell was actually an experimental Russian craft that they had populated with 13-year-olds seems ridiculous to me. For one thing, wouldn't they have claimed credit for it by now? No. But on the other hand, it makes sense that they you know, supposedly the Russians wanted to start a panic like the 1938 War of the Worlds broadcast.
Yeah.
That didn't work, obviously, so maybe that's why they don't claim credit. But that all seems very unlikely, but I mean, the thing is, the woman is a former writer for the National Review, so she has an ideologically driven conclusion. I think that, you know, it was the commies, you know.
That's the part of the book that everybody concentrates on. The book is what, like 400 or 500 pages? It's huge, and two or three of the pages.
And I'm not done with it yet. And she makes some good points. I mean, one of the first points she makes in the book is about the idea that the government could have such a huge conspiracy and keep it covered up. And everybody says, no, the government's too inept to be able to do that. Well, she points to the right example that I pointed to many times, the Manhattan Project.
Yeah.
And she also makes the point that a lot of the UFO sightings might have been the U2. Which again ties it though to Area 51.
I kind of seriously doubt that because U2s are way, 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 way up in the atmosphere.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I never understood that one. Well, there's sightings of the U2. How the hell could you mistake a plane that you can't even see flying at 80 or 90,000 feet or whatever it is for a UFO? Makes no sense to me whatsoever. I can see other things.
The thing is, they don't instantaneously appear at those higher.
No, well, they have to. They take off from an airport and they go up. But the thing is, it's basically shaped like a plane. It's just got really long wings.
Yeah, not like a saucer at all. Yeah, you're right. Right. But you know, it's big, it's huge, and there's a lot of data there. And you just gotta
see. That's a to me. That's a very, very weak argument.
Yeah, it's bordering on stupid. Like $35 book though. So
yeah.
I'd wait for it to buy it used or something.
Yeah, well, I also heard, and I don't know if this was part of the publicity or what, that some of the people she'd interviewed for the book. Wow, this thing is so bad. Some of the people she'd interviewed for the book were they didn't know that little piece was going to be in the end there, and they felt a little betrayed, making it sound like by associating their testimony with this crazy thing at the end of the book that it had cast aspersions on what they had told her. Now, you know, as you know as well as I, that a lot of things are done for effect, so maybe they're just saying that, and the people are going to believe it are going to believe it more now or whatever. But
yeah, well, I mean, it's kind of an almost ubiquitous thing when you're talking about serious historical subjects or government secrets or something. Somehow the UFO is going to be injected into the debate to make it divisive, to make people laugh at it. To otherwise discredit the whole discussion. So that's
Go ahead.
Yeah.
The
Did you hear that Edgar Mitchell is being sued by NASA?
Yes, for holding on to and then trying to sell a camera that was on one of the space missions.
Yeah. Yeah, and also recently they discovered some moon dust in St. Louis.
Where?
At an auction. At an auction, like at an estate sale.
And it shouldn't be in private hands. Is that the assertion?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Well, how do they know it's moon dust?
What's that?
How do they know the provenance of this moon dust?
I don't know. They know it shouldn't be at an auction house. That's all they know.
Yeah, well, that's if it actually is moon dust. I mean, it could be anything. It could be gravel from the side of the road or somebody's ashes from an urn or something. You don't know. But I suppose it's newsworthy.
Anyway, how do we get off on all that? Was it all?
I think it was
Adam
the
Go-Riley.
Yeah. Why do you believe in? Do you believe in aliens? You said yes. Then we went off on a tangent. Oh, he also said, and what do you base that on?
Well, you asked me the question, so I based my answer on your question.
Your assertion of yes, he means.
It just seems to me as likely as any other explanation I've ever heard, that's all.
Oh, okay.
Really.
I'm not trying to bait you into anything. We're just yakking up shit. I mean, I've got even weirder beliefs than most people.
I really think, actually, if you really want to get into it, we'd have to really get into some arcane and obscure stuff.
Yes, we would. So... Maybe we'll take that up with Adam privately. Boy, he's pumping them out here like a little printing press. What does Ken know about Leary?
Does anybody else listen to your show?
Yeah, there's a bunch of people listening, but he's the only one writing me. What does Ken know about Leary's starseed transmissions? Which I think is an interesting subject, actually.
What do I know about it?
Yeah, I think he just wants us to bring it up and yak about it a bit. Which I would be
okay,
willing
let's
to
yak about it. Well, actually, why don't I use it for shameless self promotion? Because actually, remember before I listed the things that the new product line, basically, the flagship being JFK and UFO, also the new introduction that I have for Jim Keith's book, also my chapter in the Tim Beckley book, but also I have at steamshowfest.com, I have one of my appearances with Tim Leary available on DVD at the Cafe Chaos. When Leary was here, we were hanging out. It's mostly a lecture by Leary, but I introduce him. And in fact, I'm in the dedication of one of Leary's last books called Chaos and Cyberculture.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good book.
Yeah, yeah, but this was
it's
long
a
past
fun
the
book.
Starseed transmission stuff. You know, he evolved from, you know, when he originally came out, it was all about space migration, the intensification of intelligence.
Yeah.
And life extension, the whole smile formula.
Yeah.
And eventually he came to believe that if that's not going to happen, and let's face it, we've been sluggish about migrating into space because we're too busy fighting wars against terrorists and crap like that, and that never happened. But we did get the internet, and we did get all the digital culture, and we did kind of, in Leary's metaphor, remake the central nervous system of the global culture. And you know, and that was a big plus. So I don't know if he felt that that was the ultimate expression of what he thought the starseed transmission was all about, but that's kind of like the way it worked out, I think.
Wasn't it something that he said that he had received telepathically from, he thought, some other planet while he was in prison for a while?
I was in prison, yeah.
Yeah.
He said a lot of crazy shit in prison. One of the greatest interviews you can... one of the greatest interviews you can ever see with Leary is a black-and-white film interview that he did in 1970 before going into prison, and which he seems tanned, rested, and ready, and he's very healthy, and he does say that he feels he's like one of the strongest people on the planet because he'd been through so much at that point, and that he was kind of looking forward to being in prison so that he could get some studying done, get some work done. He even mentions that he doesn't actually have to bring orgasms to women anymore, you know, as if that was a
what a job. Oh, I'm sorry, Tim.
No, yeah, well, he was a great shining light, you know. I miss Leary.
Yeah, well, anybody that is absolutely 100% for 100% total freedom is fine with me.
Yeah, well, he was for freedom and the perception of chaos, you know, the fact that we live in a chaotic environment, and a lot of people like choose to ignore that. But to underscore again, if you're a Leary fan and you want to see something by him that you haven't seen on the internet or haven't been published, check out the Cafe Chaos DVD that's for sale. And also, just to mention, God, it takes me this long to get out everything I'm doing. I got to slow down, man. That there's I got a PDF book available called Popular Parapolitics.
Oh, yeah,
a collection of all these essays about my experiences in, you know, doing conferences and stuff around the country in the parapolitical underground. That's available. That's my first attempt, actually, at doing POD. It's a PDF that I'm doing POD. And what I'd really like to do now, after JFK and UFO, is get back into publishing. Steam Shovel Press has been a cyber presence since its last hard copy issue, but I'd like to bring the magazine back, maybe in a POD format. And there are also books, important books that I'd like to put out there. Like, you know, there has never been an English translation of Paul Kammerer's The Laws of Seriality.
I've never even heard of that book, of course.
Do you know who Paul Kammerer is?
No, yes, I know that name. How do I know that name?
Code.
Huh?
Do you know the case of the midwife toad?
That's something Paul that Kammerer, Wilson talked about, I believe.
That who?
Robert who? Anton Wilson had mentioned that, well,
yeah,
in
Wilson,
his writings.
Of course Wilson talked about it. Yeah. Case of the Midwife Toad is a book by Arthur Koestler.
Oh,
and
okay.
It's about Paul Kammerer, who is one of Wilhelm Reich's biology teachers,
uh-huh,
who basically did the experimental proof of the Lamarckian view of evolution, the inheritance of acquired characteristics. His work was sabotaged by an assistant, however, and because of the public embarrassment of it all, he committed suicide. But in the footnote to the case of the midwife toad, it talks about how he collected data establishing what he called the laws of seriality, which we know as synchronicity, and we all ascribe it to Carl Jung, but it actually is a concept that Paul Kammerer came up with. And the idea, you know, he would like go out and make note of how many people had red umbrellas, or, you know, he would write down the coincidences. And
yeah,
he came up with this incredible theory that the world is maybe more connected that way than it is kind of the way we understand it, with our, you know, by coincidence, by serial coincidence.
Yeah,
it's a hard thing to wrap your mind around.
Yeah, or what we perceive as coincidence, quote-unquote.
Right, and so his book has never been translated into English. Now, I don't know German, but I know people who know German, and I would love to translate that sucker and make it the first book that I publish.
Oh, just pump it through Google Translator.
What's that?
Just pump it through Translator.
Put it through Babelfish, right? That'll make sense.
Yeah.
Hey, translation by coincidence.
One of our listeners, Carlos, wrote in after hearing us talk about the U2 and the UFO sightings. He says the U2 as UFO sightings were often reported by airline pilots who were at the time almost all ex-military, who didn't know that an aircraft was capable of flying that high. Another fairly secret aircraft, which wasn't revealed till much later, was the W/RB-57, which, according to my sources, flew even higher than the U-2. So from that angle, if you're talking about airline pilots, they could see the damn thing, and they probably wondered why the hell it was going so fast at such a high altitude.
That's a good
point,
might
but
it seems to me less likely that the UFO reports would have been that. Because you're a pilot, you're not likely to report it to anybody, or you're going to lose your career.
Well, some did report it. And some reported things that were much, much more clear and much, much more strange than a U-2 flying very high over them. I mean, lights pacing the plane and doing rings around them and all that other stuff, which has nothing to do with a U-2. Yeah. So that's why I said that's another reason that this stupid U-2 as UFO thing falls apart, for most cases, at least, I think, for me. But Carlos does bring up a good point. If the airline pilots came in and even secretly said, "Hey, look, I saw this thing," authorities probably would just say, "Yeah, that is pretty strange. It's very secret, and don't tell anybody about it. And yeah, it probably was some UFO thing," and they didn't want them to know about it because it was black project and et cetera. So yeah, I would understand that, but the vast majority of the population, I don't think, really ever saw that. And that's the nothing but school, which always pisses me off, as you know. You too, actually. You as well.
Well, you know, I saw a flying saucer at Area 51 in 92, right? We've talked about this many times. And I don't actually share the details of that with people until I've heard their UFO story, so that I don't pollute what they're telling me and what I saw. In 92, it was certainly not a U-2, and what it did was certainly not conventional.
Yeah.
That's all I can say, so, yeah.
Or at least what you saw dancing around in the sky was not, whether it was a real craft or a projection or whatever a lot of people saw, it was certainly not a conventional aircraft or a U-2 or indeed anything else that's a conventional aircraft, you know.
That's right. That's absolutely right. No, I remember that videotape of that, right? Do you remember
you said
story?
It was on the news.
And there was some kid who was at this UFO conference that I was speaking at who had his camera trained on his television that night. And the KLAS people that were with us who promised to give us their video if we let them come with us and didn't later. They showed we saw some military flares and shit, and they showed all that. And it was a little feature about, oh, look, the nuts are going out to the desert to look for the UFOs.
Yeah.
But they just right at the end of it, they showed the thing that I saw. And this kid captured it, I guess it's called a line transfer or something like that, on his camera, and I got a copy of that from him. So I've got just a few seconds, grainy shit. I mean, classic UFO sighting, right?
Well, it's KLAS, that's the station in Las Vegas where George Knapp worked. I'm not sure if he still works there, but the journalist.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
I guess it was him.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess that, yeah.
I've seen one video from Las Vegas, and it was a camera. The guy that showed me the video, and this was like way back in like the late 80s or early 90s. It was after the Area 51 thing. I mean, Area 51 thing broke, so it was probably 93 or 4. Anyway, he said the guy had pointed the camera out of his window. Maybe you've seen this. Out of a window of a hotel in Vegas, like a really high up window room. At what's the Air Force Base there? Nellis. He pointed it at Nellis Air Force Base, and there's a little kind of a butte up there that's probably, maybe 500 feet tall or something like that, off in the distance, and there's lights flying over it, and the lights look like insects. They're moving like insects. They're not moving like, and you can tell, and they go behind the mountain a couple times, so you know that it's off in the distance. It's not something in the window or something like that, and I don't think it was faked. And it was very strange. It looked like a group of three or four insects just weaving around each other and doing the falling leaf motion and all the stuff that you associate with UFOs.
That's very interesting. That's Gerald Hurd's theory, of flying saucers, that it's an insectoid intelligence.
Yes. That's in the book there. Yeah. And a friend of mine this weekend, actually, our friend Don Newcomer, said that He had just been reading Trevor Constable's book where he took the pictures with infrared and said that UFOs were living things in the atmosphere, and he called them critters. I'm not sure if he still has that same theory, because I think he's still alive, Trevor Constable. So,
Trevor Constable, I think, as far as I know, he's still alive. You know, there is an awful new book about Reich out now, right?
An awful
called,
book?
The, yeah, this is by a guy named Christopher Turner. I neglected to plug it, except that I have to intercept it and tell you that it's just as stupid a book as ever has been written about Reich. I would compare it to Albert Goldman's book on Elvis, if anybody remembers how bad that was. And it's called The Adventures of the Orgasmatron.
Oh,
and
my God.
Reviewed. Yeah, oh, it is so stupid. And it repeats all the slurs and all the smears, and it's just a real travesty against the actual history of the thing. So, of course, I'm working on a new project, a new book on Reich. I'm not sure if it's going to be my POD book or if, you know, one of my publishers I work with are going to want to do it, but hopefully it'll provide a counterbalance. But if you run into the book or a review of the book, you remember you heard it here, that it's really stupid. And if you look at it closely, the more closely you look at it, the more stupid it becomes.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of literature like that. That's it's funny. I
made a point. Oh, I actually wrote to the Wall Street Journal. And I said, "Look, this kind of review is exploiting sex talk more than Reich ever did."
Yeah,
if that's
actually
what Reich was persecuted for, these people with their, you know, prurient ideas of what Reich was all about are making more money off of it than Reich ever did.
Yeah, it's funny. I've seen articles about him in Skeptical Inquirer, the few that I did see about him. And there was a picture of him with that famous picture of him with his hair kind of sticking up and crooked and looked like he just got out of bed. Anyway, and the picture was in there, and they made fun of the picture. It's like, oh, well, look at this wacko's hair. Like, I thought you were here trying to prove by some scientific method that his theories were wrong or that he was a charlatan. No,
yeah,
we're going to make fun of his hair.
People. Yeah, we have a high standard for those skeptical people. Quote,
well,
unquote.
That's what I call fundamentalist skepticism, which you know where I got that from.
Yeah, so, I call it skepticism.
Yeah, we all have different names for it. Ken, you said you wanted to stay on for an hour and a half, and that's in 8 minutes. The hour and a half will be up.
I actually do have someone here.
Okay.
I need to get back to her.
Oh, okay. Oh, good for you. Is she listening to the interview?
No, of course not. She's playing on the computer. As always, we haven't discussed everything we need to talk about.
No, of course we haven't, which is why you have to come back on at some point in the very near future. And
plug the book.
Yes.
Yeah, how come you never have me on? You always have the same three guys on, like Walter and Paul and Nick. And you never talk to me.
Nick, I've talked to twice in the last 2 years on this show, and I think I've talked to you once in the last couple of years on this show, so that's not too bad. Paul Kimball, because he's here physically, practically every time he's on the show, and Walter because he lives about 40 miles away.
Yeah, I had an exchange with Paul on Facebook.
What kind of an exchange?
I said, do you know that the book, the best evidence is actually the famous JFK assassination book?
Yes.
You know, best evidence is documentary.
Uh-huh, Jim Morris.
And he says, oh, yeah, I read that over at Greg's house. I think I read that book over at Greg's house.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's not Jim Morris. Who wrote best evidence? David Lifton?
Lifton. And actually, it's the first book to ever publish the Wink photograph.
Really? I didn't know that. I used to, for a while, I was having lunch with David Lifton every once in a while, and I did not pick his brain in the way I should have, because for a while, and I don't know if he's still here, he was living in L.A.
When was the last time you saw David Lifton?
Probably 15 years ago or more.
Oh, okay. You know, he faded out. I used to see him all the time in Dallas, and going to the conferences or whatever, and he supposedly was writing a biography of Oswald that never materialized. And it's been years, I think, since anybody's heard from him.
Yeah, I don't know if he got disenchanted with him or with the subject or what. For some reason, I seem to recall him, one of my friends telling me that he was had gone off the subject for some reason.
Maybe he became convinced that it was a lone nut. I can't imagine.
Actually,
I make this point with people about 9/11, the difference between 9/11 and JFK in terms of conspiracy theories. JFK, you can believe in a conspiracy or you can believe in a lone nut. 9/11, there is no non-conspiracy explanation. You either believe in one conspiracy or another. It's either the jihadists or Bush and his buddies. So that to me is an improvement in consciousness as far as I'm concerned because of the ubiquitous nature of conspiracy out there.
Yeah. All right, Ken, we'll have you back on when we can finish talking about, if you want to talk more about the book, but there's like 8 zillion things we could talk about that we're both interested in.
And well, that's it. I mean, we should, you know, sometimes just do...
Shoot the shit is fine with me.
Just do conspiracies in general, you know, and maybe put JFK on the shelf for a while. I do kind of get focused on it. We were talking about Reich. I should mention, let's do some more plugs before I go.
Yes, please.
Secret and Suppressed 2, which was the book that came out... Before JFK and UFO, Secret and Suppressed 2 has my essay about Wilhelm Reich and what his relationship was with the Eisenhower administration and what the historic record shows about whatever official contacts there were between him. So if people are interested in the Reich dimension of this thing, that is your antidote, in fact, to the Orgasmatron book. Go read Secret and Suppressed 2, the chapter on Wilhelm Reich, because there you'll get some actual information. Instead of some pseudo intellectuals' ruminations about what he thinks Reich was about in the 50s.
Yeah.
And again, just to go through the list, JFK and UFO is the flagship. That's Feral House. If you want to order the book, feralhouse.com. That's the flagship. Beckley's got To Hell and Back in a Flying Saucer that has a chapter about Nazis and UFOs for me. The Childress has. Case book on the Men in Black, which has a new introduction. Jim Keith's great book, with a new introduction by me. And on steamshovelpress.com, which I am constantly updating, hopefully every week or so, I'm trying to put something into a new column called Parapolitics Offhand. And it's just a couple of sentences or something. A lot of it's like some new research and stuff from the book. Go there. You can read that stuff. And also you can find out how to get Cafe Chaos, which is the DVD with Timothy Leary, and Popular Parapolitics, a new PDF book, and get that whole Steam Shovel Press experience going for you.
And that can all be reached at steveshovelpress.com, all the stuff he mentioned. Even, I think, the newest book, you probably have a link to Feral House for that too, right?
Craig, it's always so great to talk to you, man. We just really need to do it more frequently.
Yes, and full disclosure, and I tell this to people occasionally, Ken was best man at my wedding.
I'm glad you said that, because I thought it was a big secret.
No, it's not a big secret at all. I'm proud to say it, and I just didn't want to say it at the beginning of the show.
Yes, I was, and I'm very proud to have been your best man. It was a wonderful moment in history. And, you know, Greg, you've been around for a long time, and when Paul tells you you've got clout, you do. You do, from the people that matter, you know? I mean...
People
there
with
been
money,
a
you mean?
Biopic about you yet, but we form a little underground here. And your work, I was reading Wake Up down there the other day. What a fabulous book that is. And everything you do every week on this show, it's just fantastic. You got to keep it up. You know, everybody who listens to these kinds of topics really depend on you for information, entertainment, and all that other great stuff.
Wow, Ken is pimping me now. How nice. All right, Ken. Of course, we're going to have you on sooner now just because of that.
Hey, it worked.
Well,
guy.
I'll keep in touch, and we'll set up another day, and I'll pimp that out, too, so people make sure to listen.
All right. Sounds good. Take care. Happy 4th of July to everybody.
Yes. Bye. Thanks, Ken. Bye. Ken Thomas, America's best-loved conspiracy researcher and a very good friend of mine. I know him for quite a long time. He's been really encouraging to everything I do, so it's always nice to talk to him. And you probably guess that we don't particularly agree on everything, and I will give him a little bit of shit for it, but the thing is that he doesn't get, you know, he's one of those rare people doesn't get personally insulted when you disagree with him, as opposed to Adam Gorightly, who is calling right now. Wait, let's see if we can actually hear this by turning up the phone. Are you there?
I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yes. It's coming through loud and clear. How you doing? Can you not hear me now? Is that better?
I can hear you now.
Okay, I'll put the phone up near the mic so that I can...
Oh, that's very good.
Okay.
I thought I would call in.
And you have. Yes, you are on the air right now.
What's so funny about that?
Well, you said, I thought I would call in. Blank. Pause. Dead air. How you doing?
Good.
Where are you still out in Arizona or whatever it is?
Affirmative. It's very hot out here. It was like 119 yesterday.
Great.
The monsoons are starting to come in.
Oh, good.
So it's cooling down, but Tucson is a very hot place.
Oh, you are actually in Arizona.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'll be here for a bit yet.
How are those? But people may not know that Adam is involved in the firefighting aspect of things.
Mm-hmm. We don't need to get too deep into that, but it's...
We did on one show, I think.
Yeah. It's the weather, I think, might be starting to change. They get monsoons.
Right.
Usually around this time of year, then you get some rains and it'll bring up the humidities and the fires won't be as active, but there's been a bunch of lightning around that's caused fires, so...
Hmm.
I think this has been a historic year for Arizona with fires, so...
Yeah, most definitely. Are they still going on, the fires?
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
I mean, to the point where they're basically still not very contained.
No, most of them are contained, but there's a bunch of lightning fires.
Oh, new
started.
Ones. Yeah, yeah.
But they got some rain with them, so they're not... I don't think... I haven't looked at all the reports and whatever, but I don't think they're huge. But I want to talk about Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah. Did you hear the Bigfoot show? You must have.
Yeah.
The three-hour Bigfoot show. How did you like... What did you think?
It was a bonanza.
Yeah, yeah, I should have played that at the end.
I just, it was pretty interesting. He's a pretty energetic guy, that Jeffrey Gonzalez.
Yeah, well, he's from your old main stomping grounds around Fresno, although he's actually from Sanger,
yeah,
which is right near.
Close.
Yeah,
that's only, I don't know, 20 miles from Fresno to the south. But,
yeah, southeast, I think.
But he mentioned those ruins. We got to go check those out.
Yeah, well, I'm waiting for him to... He posted something on Facebook the other day, and Ragosa, I think David Ragosa, the guy that was taking him out to the Bigfoot area, said, so when are we going out again? And Jeffrey's message back to him was, oh, I got to work this weekend. Can't be this weekend. So at the end I put, remember, I want to go.
Yeah.
So luckily for you, it wasn't this weekend. When are you coming back? Ballpark, do you know?
About a couple weeks.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, you know, if it works out, that's fine. If not, go for it. Then you can take me to the site.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'd like to hook up with those guys. They're pretty interesting. I think they're... what's the word?
Driven?
Well, I've got the impression that I think they're sincere. I think they... Listen to hear you talk to Jeffrey. I don't think he'd be all bent out of shape if I was to say that I think they... Well, maybe it would be. Perhaps they jump to conclusions sometimes.
Yeah.
You think?
Oh, them? I think when you've been looking for something that long,
mm-hmm.
you would really like to think that you've got some sort of evidence there. And I think they're...
Yeah.
I don't know if they've jumped to a conclusion. I'm not sure that Jeffrey and some of those other people actually are absolutely certain this is Bigfoot DNA. They're hoping very, very fervently that it is. I seem to get the impression that that's their attitude,
yeah.
But for the fact that they have to present themselves in public, that maybe they're slightly savvy by saying, I'm giving the benefit of the doubt, they're slightly savvy by saying, we have Bigfoot DNA, instead of saying, we think we might have Bigfoot DNA. I mean, nope, everybody's going to say, yeah, fine. If you say, we have Bigfoot DNA, people are going to immediately say, oh, yeah, prove it. And you've already got a big audience, at least listening to begin with.
Yeah. I think they're good investigators, and they got all these fancy cameras and stuff. And I would hope, you know, when I say something like that, it's just my an impression, but I'm not somebody either who is not willing to change my opinion about stuff. So anyway, I'd like to learn from those guys.
So you said you wanted to, that's as much as you wanted to talk about Bigfoot. I got a question for you. Uh-huh. You've been working around the Sierras for a while, or have worked there. Have you heard any other Bigfoot stories besides the encounters that these guys were talking about?
Just anecdotal, secondhand stuff. No firsthand witness stories. I mean, that's a huge area.
Yeah.
That have these legends of Bigfoot, but I haven't talked to anybody. I haven't seen anything. I've been out tromping around in the woods. I haven't even seen any UFOs. There's my friend Tal Levesque, who's in Mariposa, which is north, kind of northwest of where I live, and he's been investigating all kinds of weird UFO sightings, but I don't see any of this stuff, you know? The weirdest thing I saw was sitting in my hot tub one night, some colorful lights that shot across the sky, and I think it might have been some type of rocket launch or something from out in the desert.
Oh, with all the lights.
You know, I need to, sometimes you need to spend more time looking up at the stars. Maybe I haven't done enough of that in recent years.
Well, I know I haven't. I did for a while because I had that telescope, and then it got stolen out of my garage.
Yeah,
which sucked. Did you hear the whole interview? He seemed kind of surprised that I was asking him about Bigfoot and UFOs and paranormal. I don't think he expected the host to start grilling him with their own theories, which maybe I have to back off on. I don't know. I don't want to though. I have to inject my opinion into the show. It's just the way I am. And
I think he dealt with it all right.
No, he was fine with it. After he got used to it.
A little esoteric, and he, you know, that was like new stuff to him, you know, about perceptions and all that type of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I also, somebody later said, you know, I think he got kind of weirded out when he's like, I said, no, I don't think he did. I think he hadn't heard this stuff, and he wanted to hear more about it. And also,
yeah,
just the main thing about, you know, people yell at armchair or theoretical people in paranormal, UFO, or whatever you want to call it, versus the field researcher people. But I think both of those groups have something to say to each other, and they should listen to each other, because they're both going to get myopic. Because remember I was telling him that what I thought about abductions, and that that we contribute a lot of our input to it, and I didn't say it wasn't aliens or something that wasn't human, but that I don't know exactly. And he said, well, I've actually talked to a lot of these people, questioned them, separated them. Mm-hmm. And his point of view was, no, I don't think they're making stuff up, or that they're not making up, but I don't think they're hallucinating or whatever. I don't think their perceptions were bad. I think this actually is happening to them. And that's his... that's his perception from his point of view of actually talking to people, which is worth a lot.
Definitely.
I had a discussion with Peter Robbins. I said, do you really think that people are being abducted by aliens from other planets and taking their DNA? He said, yeah, I'm pretty sure. I said, why? And he said, because I worked with Bud Hopkins for years, and when you hear the same thing over and over and over and over again from widely differing people, without prompting in a lot of cases, and telling you things that are not normally covered or covered at all in the news or in the literature or anything like that, and it matches up, you start to think there's some kind of objective reality to it. And I can't, you know, what argument do I have against that? Well, of course, you don't know exactly what, you know, how far down that road can I go before I say, well, look, you may have a point.
Yeah, and Peter Robbins is, we both know him, you know him a lot better than me. He is a very grounded guy, and a very intelligent, and what's the word? He's just a tuned-in guy, so I put a lot of value in what he says.
Yeah, I would too. I mean, what am I going to do? I just tell him he's wrong? I've never investigated an abduction. I've had people tell me about them. I've had people,
yeah,
you know,
Jeffrey, I guess,
share this stuff with me.
Done a lot with MUFON, so
yeah,
probably more field invest, obviously more than I've done. I've done zip, but talking to actual witnesses who have seen something.
Yeah,
but yeah, what is that something?
Well, yeah, I did a vague amount of investigation very, very early on, and then I get disenchanted with it. But as you know from, you know, you've spoken at conventions, all that, people will just come up to you and start telling you what they saw, telling you their
true
stories,
yeah,
because they don't think there's anybody else that'll listen to them without laughing or telling them they're full of crap or whatever. And I can't laugh at them or tell them they're full of crap, even if I think they are. Because as a public service or whatever, as a human being, you want them to feel better by getting it off their chest, and a lot of the time that's all they want to do.
Yeah, I would never do that. I've never had anybody approach me where I didn't want to hear their story and wasn't respectful of it, you know. Some are a little bit overbearing at times, but
yeah. I had a woman at a party this weekend tell me her UFO story and what had happened to her. And right mm-hmm. in the middle of the story, and I was just asking her questions, a couple people started giggling uncontrollably, and I had, for the life of me, I couldn't figure out what they were laughing about. And
Greg, I heard an awesome UFO story a couple days from the fella I was working with, and, you know, he was... He kind of felt he was waiting for the laughs and the roll your eyes and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
I go, no, you know, these things happen to people quite a bit, and we kind of got into a conversation.
Yeah.
About the ET thing, and I expanded his horizons a little bit. You know, it's like
yeah.
it could have been this or that. Not only the ET, but it could have been something with your perception. It could have been somebody manipulating you, but this guy had some authentic encounter in about 84 over Lake Michigan. It blew his mind.
Yeah, well, that's what will happen to people. Their minds are blown, their lives are changed, and they can't really tell anybody about it, and there's a very bad, what's that called, a cognitive dissonance going on there, almost.
But he ended up being in a room with... a few other people, and nobody were rolling their eyes. It was like, okay, yeah, I've heard stories like that. And another person said, well, I don't discount that. There's some weird shit going on. So I think most people who have half a brain are willing to listen and not just, I think it's the people who are uncomfortable with the whole concept of something like that, who start laughing and want to devalue that experience.
Oh, well, actually, you know what? I asked later, what was the laughter for? I asked somebody who was either there or was laughing, and they said, well, what was said when we laughed was, your witness, the woman, said, you know the brightest, you know that really bright thing, the brightest thing you've ever seen?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, yeah. And she said, mine was 4 times brighter, or 10 times brighter than that, which they thought, that struck them as very funny. Like, by what standard? What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny because the laughter continued after that, and I think it's maybe a nervousness, or I don't know what it is. Or maybe it just sounded totally insane to somebody outside the conversation, because so many people have told me their stuff that I've, like, given up being judgmental about it, really. I mean, I think I'm trying to figure out if they want to hear something from me, like they think I'm going to have some sort of explanation or whatever, which I never really give. But the fact that somebody listened would talk to them about it seriously for 5 or 10 minutes is valuable.
I think there's a bit of peer pressure there, you know, with people who want to laugh at it, and they'll look around, is anybody else laughing, and that type of thing too.
Yeah, well, maybe so. Well, you know, I hear this at parties. I've heard it. I've been out to flying conventions, and some of the, oh, that's a UFO guy. So they'll come and tell me about it, and I don't really have an answer for them. But like I said, 99.9% of the time, all they wanted to do was tell me. And when they're done telling me, they might want to ask me questions. But when they're done telling me, they're generally satisfied.
Yeah. So what were your overall impressions of Fresno? What did you guys do besides go to the Bigfoot conference?
Well, we wanted to go to the Forestier's Underground Gardens, but they had tours on the hour, and we didn't get there on the hour. We got there like at 2:20, and we had to be at the we got there at 3:20, and we had to be at the conference at 4.
Mm-hmm.
So we couldn't really go, and then when the conference was over, it was closed. My impressions are that it's really hot and flat.
I'm not hearing you too good over the phone, but you said it was really hot and flat.
Yes, and the other thing was that I noticed that we drove over this very wide fast-flowing irrigation canal, and I said, this must be the canal, or one of them, where Adam Gorutley wrote about his UFO experience in Exposed Brain Matter, and I guess it's been published in a couple other places.
Yeah, I hear you much better now. So keep
I'm holding the phone up right next to the microphone I'm talking into, so you can hear through the receiver.
Yeah, that's the same canal, and we ended up filming that in the documentary.
Oh, did Sam come up there with you to film that canal?
Yeah.
It goes right by the airport there, which is where they had the conference. And when I told you, you knew exactly what I was talking about.
Yeah, it goes on McKinley Avenue, then it'll kind of, at some point, it goes north, and where we were at was like Shields Avenue, close to that, which is... So anyway, you were probably a couple miles from our UFO sighting.
Huh. But that was on acid, so it doesn't count. You know, anyway, I'm joking. I'm joking and I'm serious.
Oh, so. Yeah. I'm trying to figure out an appropriate answer.
Well, I saw some great stuff in Topanga once, but I was high out of my brain. So, I mean, I don't really repeat it to anybody or think that it was anything that important. However, I was out in Death Valley, and I saw very, very bright white light over the... hanging over basically, I think, in Nevada, maybe over the test facility, that not Area 51, but maybe a the nuclear, the bomb, what's it called? What's the bomb testing area called?
Where were you at?
We were in Death Valley, and this was like at 2:30 in the morning. We'd left L.A. late, and we wanted to go to Death Valley. And driving into Death Valley, I saw this incredibly bright white light that was, you know, it was probably... five times as big as a star. So I was pretty sure it was hanging out in the atmosphere of the Earth, and it was out over it. I couldn't tell distance, but I seemed to perceive that it was out over the border into Nevada. And it was there for, I don't know, a couple hours, and I went out there, and when we finally got to the hotel in Death Valley at 2:33 in the morning, I took some binoculars and looked at it. And it just looked like a kind of an amorphous blob that was... changing shape, but I put that down to atmospheric disturbance, you know, air densities and all like that, but it was damned bright, and it never really moved. It kind of stayed in the same spot in the sky, and then I went out and looked a little later, and it was gone, and I don't know if it had shot off or what. You know, I'm not going to sit there staring at it for hours, but before I went to bed, I went out and looked again, and it was gone.
So, obviously, you know, it's apparent why I never left it, people have UFO experiences, because I have my own crazy story to tell, you know, and I was on acid and saw all this crazy stuff, which sounds like 10,000 times more preposterous than anything else.
Well, anybody
will tell me.
There's that Bill Hicks story about going on the saucer while he was on mushrooms.
Yeah.
And he had that experience, and also Kevin Booth, his friend and producer, had the same experience, and they weren't anywhere near each other. And when they came out of the, when the drug wore off, they compared notes, and they found out they had the exact same experience, which really freaked them out. And then he used it as part of his comedy thing, and everybody laughed at it, but he wasn't joking.
Yeah.
And I didn't know this till I talked to Kevin Booth. I interviewed him years and years ago, and he admitted this to me. He said, we talked about it later, and... You know, he made a joke about it, and, you know, he talked about it in his thing, but he wasn't joking. That actually happened, and it really did freak us out, and we wondered what it was, and we still did, all the way up to his death, and I still wonder about it, he said.
Yeah, I never felt from Hicks's routine that he was joking, and, you know, that runs parallel to the experience I had with my buddy Joe, who you know.
Yeah.
we both saw the same thing, and you know, it was we were describing these things as we saw them, and it was you know, the drug maybe put us in that same state of mind, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't
true
on some level or some separate reality.
Yeah, some sort of an external reality to your perception of it. And it, you know, I would venture to say that if somebody was standing right next to you or driving along or whatever, they wouldn't have seen anything.
No.
And the point of that is that I don't think that lessens the value of it.
No.
Especially personally, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Really, yeah. Personally, it had a great effect.
Yeah.
If you could nail down those dates, and I think we probably looked in the newspapers during that time, and there wasn't shit that showed up. So, yeah, it was a personal experience.
Yeah.
We had it. You know how you're young like that? I remember we were telling our friends. And we had one friend, we were all 18 years old or so, and one friend said, a lot of people were this, thought we were nuts, and he said something to the effect that whatever it means to you is what is really important, which is pretty wise for an 18-year-old kid to say.
Fuck.
It was your experience is what he told us.
Yeah, I mean, it seems, one, it's probably something you heard somebody say, and it seemed to be appropriate at the time, and...
Perhaps.
You know? Or he was a very wise young man, I don't know.
Well, he was, but he also was the one who looked old enough to buy beer, too.
One of those dudes from the 70s. Have you... Go ahead.
He was. He was a dude from the 70s.
Did you...
Huh? Sparky was his name.
Oh, okay. Sparky sounds like a dude from the 70s. you haven't gone and registered the website dudefromthe70s.com yet, have you?
No, because I have enough on my plate. If I took that on, I'd have to actually
do something with it.
Yeah, I'm busy posting about Lindsay Lohan for president on my blog, so that keeps me busy.
Yeah, everybody visit that. So Go Rightly's Untamed Dimensions, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Which is a lot better looking website than Radio Mysterioso. So I'm actually...
Oh, no, you're doing good with Radio Mysterioso.
I'm going around and looking at everybody else's websites. It's like, well, oh, I should have that on the website. I looked at yours like, oh, I should put some nice pictures down the side, some eye candy, which is what I'm going to do this next week.
Yeah, I did that. The banner, which has some cool stuff. My brother-in-law helped me set it up back in the day. He's a web guru, so
he got
me going. Then I spent some time putting all those go-go dancers on the sidebar.
How do you like that new banner for Radio Mysterioso? Doesn't that kick ass?
Yeah, that's great. I think you're doing good with your website. Keep posting all those old podcasts. You probably have several.
I might have hundreds.
Yeah.
I'm still looking at my cassettes and all the CDs. I used to record the shows on cassettes, and then I moved to recordable CD, and in the last couple years it's been MP3s direct. So
yeah, just do, you know, every week or two or whatever.
Yeah.
Another one up there.
Yeah, I mean, I'll do it. I put up the show from the night before on Sundays on Monday or Tuesday, and then sometime before the next week, I kind of plan to put up a archived show so that there's basically something there every few days. I mean, I said this on Twitter. I had over 1,000 hits a day in the last week.
Wow.
That's kind of weird and frightening and inspiring. I don't know what caused that. It might have been Jeffrey Gonzalez and his Bigfoot DNA story.
That very well could be. He's got a lot of people interested in his work.
Yeah. We have 5 minutes. Do you want to pimp anything?
No, I'm not into that. Oh, I got to pimp just because the publisher put so much time and effort in it, and he'd be pissed if I didn't. The Who's Who of the Manson Family.
Oh, yeah.
Which is available through fijipress.com.
Yeah.
And I have a bunch of other projects, hopefully, that will come to fruition pretty soon. But, yeah, go to AdamGoRightly.com.
All right.
That's the best way to do it, at one-stop shopping.
Everybody wants to see what you're going to do next. Somebody told that to me recently, and it was very inspirational, so I'm saying that to you.
Oh, thanks. Who said that?
Ken said it, and Paul Kimball said it both to me.
Oh, good.
And that it made all the difference. In fact, the fact that everybody's looking at the website now, that was because Paul kicked my butt. He said, "Why are you not doing anything? You've got a valuable commodity here." I like listening to the show. Other people like listening to the show. So think about that. Yep. And that's what kind of got me going to get possessed, to get the site back up and the show on a sort of a regular basis and have guests on like you and Ken and not Phil Imbrogno now because he quit, apparently, the other day.
Quit what?
He quit The Paranormal, and I really like his books. Unfortunately, it has to do, I think, with academic credentials that may or may not be true, and he didn't want to fight over it. I'm a weirdo. It doesn't bother me. I like his ideas. Like people say, John Keel lied about stuff. I don't care. Look at the ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, if you want perfection in anything, especially the paranormal field, you ain't getting it. So, you know. You should study what's attractive to you and what you think is part of the answer, not somebody's stupid reputation.
Well, I don't know if anybody can say definitively that John Keel lied.
No, you can't really say it definitively, but then you see that he probably, I don't know why he believed the Fugo balloon thing, and I think he did it basically just to piss people off.
Believed what?
The Fugo balloon explanation for Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't tally with almost any of the facts of the case, but it did with a few. And he did basically what skeptics do, is they only look at part of the case and say, well, it's solved because of this. Like, well, what about this and this and this and this and this witness and this? Not that I believe Roswell was a crash of an alien flying whatever.
Well, you also got to look at, when did he write about it? Maybe if he wrote about it 20 years ago, then he got disgusted with looking into the paranormal stuff. His interest might have stopped at that point, and, you know, that type of thing.
Well, maybe so, but he was very vocal about it, and I thought it was a really weak premise, and I thought it was silly. But I don't care. I don't care if I disagree with somebody or I think they said something for effect or even made stuff up. I really don't. What I care about is their thought process, the theory they're putting forward, and does that hold up? I don't care if their reputation doesn't hold up. What I care about, because people say, well, you make the field look bad. The field already looks bad. What difference does it make?
You're preaching to the choir.
Yeah, I know. Oh, great. It's 9:58. Now there's a helicopter going over. The whole time we've been talking here, and I was talking to Ken, there's fireworks going off about every 10 or 15 minutes, and it's really loud. I don't know if you've heard any of them.
No.
People are sending up fireworks around here. It's a popular thing to do. I got to break some of mine out at home.
you do that.
I will. So you'll be back in a couple of weeks?
Yes. Okay, I'll let you go. Your time is up. It's 10 o'clock. The next show is waiting to come on. So.
Thanks for calling in, Mr. Adam Gorightly at Adam Gorightly's Untamed Dimensions.
Joy, bye.
Thanks. Talk to you soon. Adam Gorightly calling in. You've got two guests for the price of one. Ken Thomas, whose new book is JFK and UFO, Military Industrial Conspiracy and Cover-Up from Maury Island to Dallas. Interesting book, whether you're into the conspiracy angle or the UFO angle. And I used to be more into this conspiracy angle. I guess I've just gone back to my roots, and the UFO angle is really interesting. I mean, who knew all this stuff was going on behind the scenes? I thought it was just some dumb sighting that was unexplained until Ken did this. It's still unexplained, but it's a lot more detail, interesting, and indicative, reflective of the entire early era of the UFO era in this country. So check that out. It's available at Feral House website, feralhouse.com, or steamshovelpress.com. I found out that I've actually got on my computer the recording of the evening prayer chant from Istanbul. So maybe I'll end mostly with that. Radio Mysterioso will be back next week. I don't know who's going to be on. But if you follow the Twitter and look at the it's Radio Mysterioso is the Twitter name, and or look at the site, there will be news about who will be on. Or maybe it'll just be silly music. I haven't done that in a while, but we'll see. So thanks for listening. We'll be back next week, Radio Mysterioso, 8 to 10 p.m. Sundays, here on killradio.org. Thanks very much.